Things change. It's all good. We're lucky we heal. You know, I think about people my age and things we see, things that have changed, things that catch our eyes and makes me think about growing up. As we did grow up in a different era, I wish there were more people my age in here for memories. We grew up with something we don't have now. It was two opposing superpower nations. You remember that when Russia was as strong as we were? And it's back and forth between us on the world scenes and two countries immensely more powerful than any other countries out there. The United States and the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, Russia. I think I and most people in general viewed Russia as an evil communist empire that really wanted two things. And one of those was our demise, the U.S. out of the way, and the other is world supremacy that they would get from that. And then Russia, kind of surprising to me, just fell off the world scene as a superpower. Let's see, that was about 24 years ago. But they have recently reemerged, and we've seen more of them in the news. Is that important that we're seeing them come back? Are they prophetically important? What future roles, we could ask, might this large, powerful nation play? What other countries may be heavily involved in the huge military crisis coming at the end of this age that we read about and talk about once in a while? So the title I had today is, I think on this slide up here, News from the North and the East. And I thought it was interesting what spurred this. And what I'm doing is following in part an article in the May-June Good News of the title, Where Does Russia Fit in End Time Prophecy? And it's by Mary O'Seagley. So it's a good article. You might find that worth reading. I'll focus some, but not as heavily as he did, on foundational material because I think it's fairly common knowledge, information, well established in the church now. And I wanted to look a little more also at countries beyond Russia as we move forward. Regarding Russia, one of the things that came back to mind for me as I was thinking about this, my personal memories, is growing up in the Cold War era. Some of you will remember where we in Russia were kind of like this all the time. It was a climate of nonviolent but ongoing conflict between us and the very powerful Soviet Union, who we honestly feared. They had tremendous power, and we were always kind of afraid, and people had bomb shelters back then in the 60s, remember? And a lot of respect for them. And this conflict had been going on since after World War II between the United States and Russia. Some of you will remember, or maybe faintly remember, Dr. Ross, I'm afraid you're left out of this one, the Cuban Missile Crisis. But Bob, you remember, Sam, you, and I certainly remember. I was just a kid playing outside and having fun and not paying much attention when the Cuban Missile Crisis was occurring. But I remember, and you guys may too, the tension as my parents were glued to the TV for 13 days while that was occurring. Next slide, please, Jordan. And I just pulled some headlines from that era. And I missed a slide. Yep, Russia. As I was talking about them, there's Russia, the country. I should have gone to that. We're fine there, and you can see Europe to the east of Russia. So the Cuban Missile Crisis, then some slides here, and it shows President Kennedy on the left there, and U.S. blockades Cuba. And on the right, Russia says blockade is a step to nuclear war. And it was something that we had kind of worried about with this country anyway, as these bombs had developed. And so this was coming out. I'm going to quote now from a webpage I found. It's www.jfk, John F. Kennedy, library.org. By the way, I played pool with John F. Kennedy when I was a kid. It's John Francis Kennedy. A different one lived down the street from us of the same name. He got a lot of kidding about that. But quoting from that JFK webpage library, in October 1962, an American U-2 spy plane secretly photographed nuclear missile sites built by the Soviet Union on the island of Cuba. Okay, not good. President Kennedy met in secret with his advisors for several days to discuss the problem. And it was quite a problem. The potential for these missiles that close to our country was obvious to our leaders. After many long and deliberate meetings, Kennedy decided to place a naval blockade or a ring of ships around Cuba. The aim of this quarantine, as he called it, was to prevent the Soviets from bringing in more military supplies. And I think on this one, you can't read it, but it says right there, we will sink ships that won't halt. So it was a big decision. What would you do? What do you do when something like this happens? He demanded the removal of the missiles already there and the destruction of the sites that the Russians had been setting up. On October 22, President Kennedy spoke to the nation. So he said, it's time to bring everyone up to speed here. And this is what really caught my parents' attention as they were watching that TV every chance they got in the morning and the evening to see what's going on. So he had a televised address to tell everyone, this is what's happening, guys. We're handling it the best we can, best we know how. And no one was sure how Soviet leader Khrushchev would respond to this naval blockade and the United States demands at that time back in 1962. But the leaders of both superpowers, and I'm still reading from this JFK site, recognized the devastating possibility of a nuclear war. For 13 days, the world waited, seemingly on the brink of war, and hoped for a peaceful resolution to the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I was just young enough to not worry or care back then, just to kind of have an impression made. Kennedy won the chess match, and the Soviets did back down at that time from what they were doing. Many of us will remember the more recent shocking collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. That gets into more of our age range. Jasmine, you probably remember that. No, 1991. In no small part, they bankrupt themselves trying to keep up with our war machine, hoping to pass our military capability. What struck me most about that fall of the Soviet Union, was how fast it occurred. It just seemed to occur overnight. They dropped from being one of two world powers, superpowers, we always call the United States and the Soviet Union, one of those two to third world status. Being in the church at the time, it always made an impression on me about how fast economic failure can occur. Fear that we might similarly fall because of simple economic failure. So a major point of Mr. Siegley's good news article is that while Russia fell, they are back now. In 2014, so that's just last year, and I know you all remember this, they flexed their muscle and violated a 1994 treaty they had, so therefore made shortly after their fall, that they would respect borders of the Ukraine, once a part of Russia. Next slide. If I keep up. Okay, so Ukraine is right over here, and down here is the Crimean Peninsula. We hear about some on the June, or some on the slide, and in the news. So last year, the Crimean Peninsula, part of the Ukraine again, was taken over and annexed by Russia in the face of very strong criticism by European Union and by us. Why the criticism? Well, in large part because a sovereign country was being attacked without real provocation, and because of fear that this aggression by Russia could expand into other European countries. And we kind of know what Putin grew up with and what Russia had been reduced to. And there was fear for Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and other countries. We should actually not be surprised to see Russia now back on the world scene. Bible prophecy gave a strong indication that Russia would rise again and play a significant role in end time events. So this should be no big surprise to us to see that, yes, they are here. It kind of moves us along on the clock. Who are they prophetically? What are these prophecies? Is Russia the coming king of the north? Or at least part of the king of the north? And we know that they're not. They're not that, or we should, I think. But as we watch world conditions following the admonition of Christ to do so, and let's look in Luke and see that, Luke 21. We were very close to this a moment ago with Mr. Beam. Luke 21. And verse 8. And Christ said here, "Take heed that you may not be deceived, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he.'" There will be people falsely representing Christ, and the time has drawn near. "Therefore, do not go down after them. But when you hear of wars and commotions, do not be terrified, for these things must come to pass first. But the end will not come immediately." Then he said to them, "Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom." And he goes through problems and difficulties that will occur. And in verse 36, "Watch, therefore," said Christ, "and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things." Yeah, that's an easy thing not to pray. And once in a while I try to slip that in, as we're told by Christ here, because there are difficult times coming. And Christ says to watch. Watch that you may be accounted worthy to escape these things. So let's consider Russia as we do what Christ said, and we watch. And other role-playing powers, they're going to play a part in the crisis at the end of this age. Let's be watching. To get started, and Mr. Siegley did this in more detail than I would, I thought we should first set the stage of nations and powers to surround Israel and who they are prophetically, the geography. Next slide. So we're talking about, here's the Mediterranean Sea, this area right here where Israel is. We see Europe up here. I can't see it very well, but Spain and France should be here. It looks like the UK up there and Germany in this region. Italy down here and Russia wrapping around the corner. And then all the Arab lands here wrapping around Israel to the south and to the east. And that will help us with understanding these specific prophecies that we'll look at today. Ultimately, what we're seeing today, out there as we look, and what the world will see soon, all traces back to Abraham, interestingly enough, who was placed by God in this region here, over here along the Mediterranean Sea, in the Promised Land. What did God promise Abraham and his wife Sarah? Next slide. Jordan, thank you. And let's go back to Genesis 17 and see here God talking. This would be Christ. Genesis 17 and verse 5. Genesis 17, 5. "No longer shall your name be called Abram, but you shall be called Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you." So this is a promise of God to Abraham. God's intention was to use Isaac, and he did use Isaac, but things got a little more complicated. Even though God had promised this couple up here a son, Abraham and Sarah, you know the story, they decided to help God a bit when Sarah wasn't delivering, wasn't having a son, a child, and Sarah brought her handmaiden Hagar, and they had another son. Next slide. And so that's depicted here. Of Ishmael and his descendants, given this event, God said, and let's look in Genesis 16, in verse 3. It's a good example when we don't follow instructions, the trouble that can come. Genesis 16, in verse 3, reading there, "Then Sarah, Abraham's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and said, 'I'll fix this problem.'" God's evidently not getting it, the job done. "And gave her, Hagar, to her husband Abraham to be his wife," or like his wife, "after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she," this is Hagar, "saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes." It's kind of like, so I'm the one bringing the child. It's not you, Sarah. You're just not as good maybe as you thought. "Then Sarai said to Abram, 'My wrong be upon you. I gave my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she started hating me. I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between you and me.' So Abraham said to Sarai, 'Indeed, your maid is in your hand. Do to her as you please.'" And limited reasons in life to act like this, but sometimes we do. "And when Sarai dealt harshly with her, she fled from her presence." Verse 7, "Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. And he said, 'Hagar, Sarah's handmaid, where have you come from and where are you going?' And she said, 'I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress, Sarai.' And the angel of the Lord said to her, 'Return to your mistress, submit yourself under her hand.' And then the angel of the Lord said to her," and this is about the nations now that will come from Abraham, "'I will multiply your descendants exceedingly, so they will not be counted for multitude.' And the angel of the Lord said to her, 'Behold, you are with a child, and you shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction.'" Verse 12 then, this prophecy of Ishmael and his descendants, "He shall be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him." God's description, this description we just saw in verse 12 of Ishmael's descendants, is significant because many of today's Arabs are Ishmaelites, descendants of the same Ishmael, Abraham's son. His father was Abraham. And this is recognized. It's very well recognized by the Arabs today who trace their lineage through Ishmael's sons, one of whom was their prophet Muhammad. God later did provide the promised son through Sarah. So the next slide shows that. That son being Isaac, the son God intended. Isaac married Rebecca and had twin sons, Esau and Jacob. Next slide. And even before they were born, God reveals about them. Genesis 25, in verses 21 to 23. Genesis 25, verse 21. "Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled together within her." They were fighting even before they were born, these children. "And she said, 'If all is well, why am I like this? Why is this happening?'" Must have been quite a feeling. Never being pregnant myself and feeling the movement, but having two carrying on, I guess. "So she went to inquire of the Lord about this, what's happening. And the Lord said to her, 'Two nations,'" so we're back to nations from Abraham's descendants, "'two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other. And the older," that's Esau, "shall serve the younger," and that's Jacob. So more prophecy. The descendants of Esau, then, also called Edom, and Dr. Ross gave a nice message three weeks ago, maybe, about Edom. If we look in Genesis 25, just touch a verse or two here, Genesis 25:29, we'll see, "Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was tired. he was weary, his brother Esau. And Esau said to Jacob, please feed me. So we know this story very well. I'm very weary. Therefore, his name was called Edom. Feed me the same red stew. And Edom means red. But Jacob said, sell me your birthright as of this day. And Esau said, well, Jacob was going to receive the birthright anyway from God, but he took it himself and more problems. Esau said, look, I'm about to die. All right, that's an exaggeration. I'm weary, I'm hungry. What is this birthright to me anyhow? Very devalued in Esau's eyes. Then Jacob said, swear to me. And so he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew. And he ate, drank, arose, and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright, and he also despised his brother. That was a difficult point for them. Esau's descendants then intermarried with Ishmael's descendants and produced a large part of today's Arab peoples. Next slide shows Arab lands in the Middle East. As God said of Abraham, nations shall come from you. These people grew, and the family bitterness and resentment of what is now Arab nations against Jacob's descendants has intensified through the century. And you've heard the Arabs describing Israel here as, we want to push them into the sea and just get rid of them. So that there is considerable animosity, and we see how it all traces back today. 22 nations in the Middle East and North Africa are Arabic nations, trace their heritage to Ishmael and Esau, and are mostly adamant adherents to Islam, religion Islam. We're all very aware then, as I continue to set the stage here, Isaac's other son, Jacob, Abraham's grandson, was renamed Israel. Next slide then shows Jacob with his 12 sons, from which the 12 tribes of Israel are descended. These tribes, too, couldn't get along even among themselves. And they divided into a northern and southern kingdom, which are pictured in color on the map on the screen up there. The Jews, the southern kingdom, are descendants of three of Jacob's sons, three tribes, and that would be Judah, from whom the name Jew comes. Benjamin decided to join Judah and a part of the priestly tribe of Levi. There's lots more detail in the U.S. and Great Britain in prophecy, and there's good detail, Mr. Sigley's Good News article. And these brothers, these tribes grew and became the kingdom of Judah around Jerusalem. Unknown to most, but vitally, vitally, vitally important, the northern 10 tribes were never called Jews, which I think we know so well. Historically distinct and politically separate from the Jews, they were not of Judah. They were not of the kingdom or house of Judah. The tribes to the south formed the kingdom of Judah, while the northern tribes became the kingdom or the house of Israel. So much stage setting here for understanding what's occurring in the world. So this northern tribes, the house of Israel, the kingdom of Israel, are carrying with them Jacob under his name, his new name, then Israel. I'll read now some from the U.S. and Great Britain in prophecy. After being deported in a series of invasions at the hand of the Assyrians, right, and we're all very aware, the inhabitants of the kingdom of Israel, that would be this kingdom up here, this group carried away by the Assyrians, would lose their identity after kids were born and they had kids and they forget their history and where they were in faraway lands. More than a century later, the kingdom of Judah, now that's this kingdom down here, house of Judah, was defeated and exiled by the Babylonians. However, unlike Israel, they remembered who they were. They held on to their heritage. They retained their identity, and many return to their homeland after 70 years of exile. And our literature then carefully traces the northern tribes, biblical Israel, into Assyria and from there into Europe. Next slide. And this one I think I pulled right out of our U.S. and Great Britain and prophecy. So here we have the area of Israel, the northern tribes here, the southern tribes here. Northern tribes carried away captive in this direction, and then the Bible carries them to the north and to the west from there into Europe. And it's well beyond the scope of what we're doing today to follow this in any detail, but we're aware that shortly after he died, Jacob placed his name, again, Israel, and I think I have a slide showing that, on two boys, the sons of Joseph, and here we have him doing that. And he did this curious thing where he crossed his hands to the dismay of Joseph, and he put his right hand on the younger boy's head, that would be right here on Ephraim's head, and he blessed the two of them. And so what's so critical to realize, I remember first reading this, is that there is nothing Jewish about these boys. They even have an Egyptian mother, but they're far removed from the tribe or house of Judah that became today's Jews. So Jacob, Israel, said, "Let my name be placed upon these boys," his grandsons Ephraim and Manasseh, whom God then said would become a multitude of nations, which we see as the British Commonwealth, and a single great nation, which we see as Manasseh, United States, world powers. And we trace those, and I'll not do that today. I'll simply refer you to the U.S. and Great Britain and Bible prophecy for more details. Okay, now let's read from a 1983 Plain Truth article by Herbert Armstrong. I don't know why I selected this one. I just saw it. We've got many that are older. We've got many that are newer. But this one was there in 1983. That's 32 years old about. And in that he said the astounding background to the crisis in the Middle East. So that's the title of the article. And Mr. Armstrong provided a detailed focus on Daniel 9 through 11. Very exciting. Successive prophetic resurrections of empires. And the next slide, you'll recognize this figure then from our literature. These successive empires have all become historic. You read about Daniel, and people who don't want to believe the Bible will say clearly this book was written later than it claims to be, because it would have to be from God to be this accurate. But then everything in Daniel and archaeologically points to that it really was written when it claims to be written. But anyway, we can follow these empires through history, and they have all become, they've come up and they've gone away, except for the last. They began with Daniel's Babylon, followed by the Medo-Persian, or the Persian Empire, I think it says up here, followed by Greece under Alexander the Great. Alexander died and his four generals split his empire, we know, and the next slide shows those empires. And there's a coin there with Alexander on it. Daniel and prophecy then primarily follow two of these four empires, and they're the top two shown in this list of his four generals. Follow two of the four divisions: Egypt, called the King of the South because it's south of Jerusalem, and the Syrian kingdom, called the King of the North, governmentally just north of Judea. And because the Holy Land was passed back and forth between these two divisions, and wars between them were principally over possession of Judea, we find important prophecy concerning them. So the fourth, the next empire, Rome, conquered the empires of Greece, of Alexander, and became the fourth empire described in Daniel. I think maybe in Daniel 2, about there where we see that. What history now calls the Roman Empire of 168 BC. Next slide shows this Roman Empire. It's amazing how it looks like Europe, doesn't it? So similar to the lands of Europe. The Roman Empire has seen 6 of its 7 prophetic resurrections. Next slide lists those. And it is fascinating. So I remember the first time I went through that. Look, here they are, 1, 2, 3, and you count these. And it goes up. History shows all of these. All except one more coming, which we really believe now exists, at least as a precursor, ready to suddenly bloom into this final empire, now in the form of the European Union, largely occupying the same lands. I've got EU up there, EU lands up there, the same lands. And so that overview that we just did sets the stage for the modern final clashes where, and we don't by any means know all the details of how this will all occur. The Arabs, Ishmael, Esau, nations from Abraham will unite under a very powerful leader, some leading figure who is coming, and come to the point where they feel strong enough to challenge this northern empire, this final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. Let's look in Daniel 11. And then we'll see this description. Obadiah, overshot. Hosea, we're getting close. Daniel, there it is. Daniel 11 and verse 40. So now we've set these nations. And here, verse 40, Daniel 11, 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. So if we look at the word attack in here, we'll see other versions, translations say we'll push at him, we'll engage him, we'll collide with, we'll oppose, we'll lock horns with. So we don't know what they'll do, but they will somehow push the king of the north until the king of the north decides, I better do something about this. Today, watching the news, and this is what it's all about, what all this is leading to, you have to wonder, I do anyways, I look at the Arab lands and I look at this ISIS forming and how well organized they are, how well financed they are, you wonder, are they the ones on their way to becoming the final Islamic king of the south, sons of Ishmael? We don't know. Someone will. Some group will raise up and take that role. Next slide does show some of ISIS I pulled off. I had pulled this one off a little while ago. This one was on CNN, the top one earlier this week. I think it was Thursday when I just pulled up CNN. There it is. So I drug that one on too. This ISIS, this Islamic State, is powerful, determined that we will all be Islamic, ruthless adherence to Islam. Daniel 11:40, then, where we just were, says, the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, with all their war machine, with everything they've got. They shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through them. They're going to hit with overwhelming, deadly response. I sometimes speculate, and it's just me wondering, because we don't know if there will be an Islamic hand in the coming catastrophic fall of this country. And the Europeans are going to watch from where they are. They're going to see across, but there's too many of us. It'll be too big a fall. Prophetically, we know over 90% of this country won't survive what's coming, and they're not going to greatly be able to help. If something like that occurs with this country, how are they going to feel when the Islamic bloc pushes at them or attacks them? Does verse 40 make sense? And the king of the south shall come against him like a whirlwind. I think this will be viewed as nothing less than a survival attack by the Europeans. As we saw what happened in the United States, and it was horrific, and we are not going to let anything like that happen to us. It will be viewed as nothing less than a survival attack. What we're reading about here, them descending on the king of the south like a whirlwind. Verse 41, he, This is the king of the south, shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape his hand, and we have a list of a few there. In verse 42, he shall stretch out his hand against the countries and the land of Egypt. This southern kingdom shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. What again is the time frame of this prophecy we're reading about? Verse 40, at the time of the end. You know, as an insert, and our literature does this, and Mr. Siegley does a little more. This approximately corresponds to Revelation 6, opening of the fifth seal, to be shortly followed by the sixth seal, and some just unprecedented times on this planet. Okay, so if we think about it then again, if we just think, what would happen in a world when the king of the north does this and descends on the Arab bloc like that? How will other countries respond to the king of the north taking possession of these lands? How will Russia respond to this? The largest country in terms of landmass on the earth, almost double the next largest, which is Canada, not a powerful country. How will Russia see the overrunning and taking control of lands vital to its survival? What would you do in an event like this? Russia, probably at this time the only remaining superpower. Can we trust that God knows? He says he does. Roles countries like Russia will play in the end time. Hold your place in Daniel and just turn back to Isaiah. It's not too far from here. Isaiah 46 and verses 9 through 10. As again, Christ said, watch. Isaiah 46, 9 through 10. Watch. Keep your eye on what's going on out there. Verse 9. Remember history, says God. Remember the former things of old. For I am God and there is no other. I am God, there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning. I have already told you what's coming. I have declared it. And from ancient times, things that are not yet done, you will find these, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. So yes, God says, I do know, and I have revealed these things that are coming. Let's look now back in Daniel where we held on in verse 44. I think we better go up to 43. Why is Russia concerned? The king of the north has just done what? He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver. How much money has the United States poured into, and others, into this area with all the oil? Treasure over the gold and the silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, of this southern kingdom, of this area. That would include the oil. So there's considerable reason for the Soviet Union to say, we're going to need to do something when we see the king of the north come down and the king of the south. So if we look at verse 44, is that what we find indicated here? Where the prophecy reveals that indeed someone else has decided it's time for them to become involved. They must be involved. Verse 44, but news from the east and the north shall trouble him. And this is the king of the north that we're talking about. News from the north and the east. Since this news troubles the king of the north, we know there's another northern power that is also to the east. And next slide. And so here's Europe. Here's the area of Israel and the Arab nations around. And then here's Mediterranean Sea and the area of Israel. Europe, king of the north. And here's Russia, and we'll see to the north and the east. News from the north and the east, verse 44, shall trouble him. Therefore, he shall go out with great fury, and here's his intent, to destroy and annihilate many. So the king of the north says, okay, we've got another survival problem coming here, and it's from someone, from another northern power. And with this, it's important for what we just read here, to the north and the east, title of the message today in verse 44, to recognize there is no equivalent Hebrew word to northeast, the term for northeast, so making this direction the right one for Daniel to use, of a nation, an end time power in the direction of present Russia. So it suggests that Russia is actually the only world power in that direction, making them look like a reasonable candidate, and for that matter, the only one in that direction strong enough to make trouble with the king of the north, to trouble them. We should consider alternately, or in addition, and probable addition, that Daniel could be referring to a challenge that comes not only from the north, northeast, but also from the east. As those countries too, those who are strong enough to consider doing something, and now in a very heavily impacted world, decide that they also must act. What second true world power then lies to the east of this troubled region and has huge economic interest in the Middle East? Next slide. So here we have Saudi Arabia and Iran and Iraq and the Arab region. And over here, Israel here, straight to the east, we do find another very large world power. Now the number two world economy, China, and rapidly growing on a faltering United States. Mr. McCurdy was talking about that with me this morning, about China and the Soviet Union. I thought, it's amazing, that's exactly what I plan on talking about. Quoting again from our Good News article, Russian relations with China, its biggest neighbor, are now thriving, buoyed by a 30-year deal agreed to last May. So here he's referring to May 2014, 1 year ago now, to supply Siberian gas to China by pipeline. China has a huge demand for Russian energy, and for in that regard, China has a huge demand for energy in general, as they have so greatly grown. And as another member of the UN Security Council, so I'm still reading here, it is an important diplomatic shield to Russia. End of that quote. What might drive Russia and China, again, as we think, as we look out there, to join forces with this king of the north? Well, they're already allies. They have mutual and major concerns to any threat on Middle East oil. Sea lines controlled by the Middle East, sea lanes, are important to both nations, and the joint power of these two countries is formidable, if not non-opposable. China can field a huge army and has rapidly growing technology, while Russia possesses first-rate military power, including a large nuclear arsenal. So that would be a very powerful duo. From that point, the book of Revelation expands on what we find in Daniel and describes a very major end-time military advance on the region of the Holy Land that comes from the east in the region of the Euphrates River. And I think this next slide, I just pulled one of the old ones in. I suppose I was a little lazy, but it shows the Euphrates River right here, and it crosses through the river that Syria and Iraq, or the region right here, Syria and Iraq. So Revelation describes a very major advance from the east into this region. This river has been a historic boundary between the ancient Roman Empire and lands to the east, often adversaries in that direction. Let's look at this troop advance coming in the area of the Euphrates. Revelation 9. Now, as we've seen the king of the north, And we've seen news from the east and the west troubling them. I'm sorry, from the north and the east troubling them. In Revelation 9, verse 13, then the sixth angel sounded. Okay, so we've had a lot of very hard times at this point. We've gone through the six seals of Revelation. We're in the seventh seal that contains the seven trumpet plagues. Very, very, very difficult times on the face of the earth. And we're up to the sixth of those seven trumpet plagues as we approach this end time event. The sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. We could review these times we've been through at this point. I think you're familiar, so we won't do this as we've gotten into the seventh seal and approaching the seventh trumpet. I expect people are hardened, desperate now, and used to death as we've reached this point of the sixth trumpet plague, also called the second woe, verse 15 and 16, for the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and the day and the month and the year were released to kill a third of mankind. This is a terrible battle for survival of nations that is being described here. Now when the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million. I heard the number of them. I remember reading this number as a teenager and thinking, there's no way anyone could put together an army that size. I mean, that's bigger than the entire United States. Back then, we were very close to 200 million as I read that. Bigger than the entire United States. It's just not possible to put together an army that large, was what I thought when I first came across that verse. Is it possible now? The population of China is 1.3 billion. Add Russia's 150 million or so people. It's probably sufficient. Should these major nations to the north and east feel they must become involved? Which at this point only makes sense. And it's quite possible that nations like India and Japan, also to the east, will join in. Again, this will be viewed as a survival thing, and they will certainly be playing for keeps. How will the King of the North respond then, as we get to a situation like this that nobody wants to be in, but here we are? And we saw this already in Daniel 11:44. He will go forth to destroy and annihilate. There's probably not going to be a lot of choices. They're going to be giving it their all, too. And it's just not going to be a nice time. Watch always and pray that you may be found worthy to escape these things. Place of safety is going to be a really way cool, wonderful place. So what we've been reading about then is the coming battle of the time of the end. All these things leading up to a final march, a final war on the Holy Land, biblically referred to as Armageddon, and the great battle of Christ's return. All these nations, starting with Abraham, in which all these armies, the King of the North, and others who are going to join in, the King of the from the North and East, are destroyed. Who's going to destroy these armies? Each other? Well, no, it's actually us with the returning Christ that will fight these armies. So that's going to be quite an event too, and stop this Satan-inspired thing and then deal with them later when they're resurrected in the second resurrection. You have to wonder, though, what these people are thinking. Seeing the returning Christ, turning to fight him, with all the saints, all the spirit beings, it seems obvious they won't recognize him at all, who he is. And that's the world we're in now. I'm not thinking our country would if he was coming back to this country in this way. What will we think? We can be sure that Satan has stirred these armies up to the extent of his ability. This is kind of his last hurrah of the age. You kind of have to wonder if they think Christ and the spirit beings are extraterrestrials coming back to take over the earth, and they very quickly turn to fight them. Well, whatever, it will be a very short battle. So with that, let's go ahead and wrap up this. We've reached the final battle. We've looked at prophecies leading to a last human war seen by participants as a war for their very survival around the Holy Land and involvement of potential major role-playing nations from the north and the east. Russia looks like a very viable candidate. China looks like a very viable candidate for major role players in this. There's much greater detail in our booklets, You Can't Understand Bible Prophecy. Book of Revelation unveiled at last. The Middle East in Bible prophecy. As we move forward, it will be important that we do watch these nations in Europe and the north and the east of the Holy Land. It's interesting, we never see in news from the West troubled them. Another indication we're just not going to be in the picture right then. So let's watch these people. Be aware of the stage that is now well on the way to being set for these final events. The good news is, and let's close with this, Isaiah 2, this is a terrible war and a terrible time we would like to avoid. And then these armies will be destroyed by the returning Christ. And then Isaiah 2, verse 1, and the word that Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days. So we're at that same time that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on top of these other governments, these other nations, and shall be exalted above the hills. All the nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us some ways that are actually going to work. For the first time in the history of this planet since the fall of Adam and Eve, we shall walk in his ways and his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law. Whoops, I thought it was done away with. Sorry, I'm ad-libbing too much. Shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. And they're going to say, what were we thinking? And they shall beat their swords into plowshares. And they're going to grow some nice vegetables and fruit. And their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation. Neither shall they learn war anymore. Part of the joy of being in the church is when this stuff happens, you know what's on the other side, and it will be okay, and that's what we just finished reading with.